Okay. Hello, hello, welcome everyone. Hello, my name is Lisa Falsko, CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council. It's such a pleasure to see everyone here on this very summer warm afternoon. We're so glad that you chose to come to this World Affairs Council program. Do we have any new people in the audience? If you, this is your very first World Affairs Council, would you mind raising your hand? Do we have any new folks? Okay. Thank you so much for coming. We have a great season that we are working on, so please check our emails and websites and Facebook and see what's going on. We've got a lot coming up. We do also have a Great Harvest bread basket. For only $2, you can get a raffle ticket. If you haven't done so yet, there's not too many tickets in that basket, so you've got a great chance. You can hurry and do that. We'll call that number in just a few minutes. Today's program is the second part of our centennial celebration program where we look at Anchorage's place in the world. And we want to thank, I haven't seen her yet, but Nina Kempel and the fine folks at the Humanities Forum who are dedicated in discussions and world issues and making programs like today possible. It allowed us to do some advertising for today's program and let the folks like you know about the World Affairs Council and this program today. We are a membership organization, and if you are currently not a member, we'd like to encourage you to do so. The Alaska World Affairs Council was started in 1958 by the late Evangeline Atwood, so we've been here longer than Alaska has been a state. We are part of a 90-plus council system in the United States, and we are the largest international education grassroots organization that exists, and we're very proud of that. And the Atwood Foundation, to recognize this, would like to help encourage people to join the World Affairs Council and continue what Evangeline Atwood started here in 1958 to bring more programs like the one you see here today in the future. So if you become a member and you're currently not a member of the World Affairs Council, they will match your membership dollar for dollar. And if you are a current member and you increase that membership by anything, $10, $20, they will match that increase dollar for dollar. So please help us take advantage of this and support the World Affairs Council and our programming in the future. If you could take a moment also to silence your cell phones. This program is being recorded both audio and visually. But while you have your phones out, I would encourage everyone to continue this conversation started today on the virtual sphere by tweeting at AK World or tagging Alaska World Affairs Council on Facebook. We've had a lot of interest and a lot of great conversations going. So please be part of this conversation and tweet at AK World or tag us on Facebook. Speaking of recordings, I'd like to thank Alaska Public Media for being here today. And this program is recorded for the radio and TV, like I mentioned. You can access our programs either through our website, we have a link to the recording, or directly at alaskapublicmedia.org and search for AWAC event, AWAC Presents. And there you'll be able to get a copy of the program and you can send it to all your friends and let them know why programs like today are important. While you are on Facebook or looking at our website, I would encourage you to look at the websites of World Trade Center Alaska, AEDC, and Alaska Common Ground. They partnered with us for this program, and they have similar type of discussions and programs coming up. They're great organizations. We really appreciate their partnership, and I encourage all of you to look at their websites as well and see what else is coming as far as these types of programming. Oh, and look at that. Here we have the winning ticket. I'll ask our illustrious Dr. Dunscombe to pull the lucky winner. Wow, CPAs would approve of that sort of method. That was pretty good. If you have 225742, you won a Great Harvest bread basket. So the front desk, congratulations. Mm-hmm. You might have also noticed on your table we have a card of the bios of our speakers. To save time, you can take those and read those and take them home with you if you'd like. And we also have a quick survey, and your opinion is valued to us. It'll only take you a minute or two. If you don't mind, after this program, filling out that survey, it'd be greatly appreciated. And with that, I'd like to hand over the microphone to Dr. Dunscombe, who's our incoming chair of our board of directors, Professor Dunscombe.
Thank you very much, Lisa. Very pleased that all of you could take time out from another glorious summer day in Anchorage to join us here. Very happy to be here. I think it points up very much both the importance of the topic and the recognition of the importance of this topic, but also is appropriately, I think, part of Anchorage centennial celebration, recognizing the history and what has happened over the past 100 years, but also how much has changed in the last 100 years. And I think speaks very importantly to the story of Anchorage as, you know, a narrative of the actions of individual people. And as a professor of history myself, one who believes very strongly in the humanities, I think situations like this, events like this, and the work of the Alaska World Affairs Council provides a very important service to Anchorage and the community. If you'll forgive me, I'll lapse into my announcer's voice when I say this program is made possible by the support of the Humanities Forum, for which we thank them very much. So, without further ado, very much like to begin. One of the things that I do need to do is to set up things, tying into the history a bit, the history of Alaska's economy. This is actually very simply done because it's dominated by three major themes. These have been a cycle of boom and bust based on primary resource extraction. So we start with fur seals, we go to gold, to fish, to timber, to oil, and now we're on the verge of the boom and bust cycle in gas, it would appear. Of course, the capital to pursue this economic development has had to come from the outside historically, and of course the profits derived from that exploitation have tended to go outside. So people in Seattle and San Francisco and all along the West Coast have been very grateful for the resources of Alaska. And finally, another critical aspect in terms of the development of Alaska and certainly Anchorage's economy has been the role of the federal government in Alaska's development. Indeed, Anchorage would not be here, we would not be celebrating this centennial without the federal government decision to build the Alaska Railroad, to headquarter it here. And indeed, the place where we are now, quite literally, was laid out by federal railway engineers. So that is, you know, as much proof as ever one would want. The state of Alaska has really kind of hitched itself to oil's star since the 1960s, and we have become, very much over the last 40 years or so, a petro-state, overwhelmingly dependent on the fluctuating price of a single commodity. Of course, with the sudden decline in the price of that commodity, and I'm sure many of you are aware that that commodity hit $48 today, down from recent peaks, the economy of the state of Alaska has been in deep fiscal crisis as a result of this. And yet, despite this history of dependence on resource extraction, tied to a single commodity, we have actually managed to grow an Alaskan state economy, which is much more diverse, much more resilient, and certainly compared to the oil crisis of the 1980s, which some of you may remember, has managed to hold up much better. And this is due in large part to the work of people like our panel today. So let me briefly introduce them. To my immediate left is Larry Cash, who's president and CEO of RIM Architects. They have been active in one of the really kind of lost or underappreciated areas of the Alaska economy in terms of providing services both within the state of Alaska, but also outside to the lower 48, but also internationally. And indeed, we have roughly a $5 billion export economy in terms of things, but we have not quite equally as significant, it's a little hard to count, but a very substantial component of service exports. And RIM Architects has been a very important part of that, doing work all along the Pacific Rim, China, Taiwan, Japan, but also on the West Coast, and also in Guam and Saipan. Dr. Margie Brown is former president and CEO of Cook Inlet Regional Incorporated, has been kind of worked her way up through the Siri over the course of years, and points to the importance of the presence of Native corporations in the Alaska economy, which in its own way was kind of an almost afterthought creation of the attempts to get the Alaska pipeline built, the whole Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, the Alaska National Interest Land Claims Act, ANCSA and ANILCA were basically designed to clear the way for construction of the pipeline, and yet they've had very important consequences for the state of Alaska. And Dr. Rashmi Prasad, Dean of the School of College of Business and Public Policy at the University of Alaska Anchorage, speaks well, I think, to the importance of the university's role in preparing people for to participate in that economy, not just to service it, but also to help grow it as entrepreneurs and innovators. So, that's enough of me. So what I would like to do is to ask each of our panelists some questions about what we need to do, what resources we need to invest in to help Alaska's global economy to grow. And the first question is, what is your impression of how the Alaskan state economy, as opposed to the economy of the state of Alaska, is doing from your particular perspectives? How does it look, especially in comparison to the economy of the state of Alaska? So we'll start with Larry.
Wow, thank you. So the economy of the state of Alaska and my arena has been impacted significantly since the crash of the price of oil about a year ago. And, you know, our company has felt it significantly here in Anchorage. And as the price continued to decline, decisions were delayed. Let's wait and see what's going to happen. Began to happen, and you know, all of those sorts of decisions are felt pretty quickly in the service industry that we're a part of. And at the same time, we are very fortunate to have diverse locations in the Pacific Rim, Guam, Hawaii, California. As I was talking earlier, our Guam location is all of a sudden really busy, so they're experiencing a peak while Alaska is experiencing a dip. And you know, we're fortunate to be able to help Guam meet their project demands by utilizing our excess capacity in professional resources here in Alaska. So I'll leave it at that.
Margie Brown.
Yes, thank you. I'm happy to be here today. Well, I think anybody who does business in Alaska is affected by the state of Alaska's economy, no doubt. And so, you know, I think that's just a given. But speaking from Siri's perspective, very early on, Siri decided to invest outside the state of Alaska, trying to diversify away from heavy reliance on just one geographical area and one economy. And a lot of this had to do with the fact that, as you indicated, these Alaska Native corporations are creatures of Congress. We were told to go out and form yourself as a for-profit corporation and go do well and be well and provide benefits to your shareholders without a lot of guidance about how to do that and what you should be doing. It's a very unconventional way to get into business. And so there were a lot, there were 12 regional corporations in the state, and it was very clear early on that this market, even and back in the 70s when these organizations were formed, was much too small to accommodate all of us. And so I think SERI was one of the very first of the Alaska Native regional corporations to recognize that it needed to go outside of the boundaries of Alaska to make its investments. And those early investments happened to be very specifically not that related to the oil and gas industry, which of course so much of Alaska's economy is related to. So we were into things like wireless telephone business, as that was a groundbreaking new technology, or radio and TV broadcasting. So I think that Native corporations have, and there are more now who are going outside of Alaska. Almost all of them have interests outside, business interests outside of Alaska, and many of them have interests, business interests around the globe, particularly pursuing government contracts. When I became the president and CEO of SERI, I thought we could adjust our business strategy somewhat and not focus entirely outside of the boundaries of Alaska. And you will see then now some very concrete examples of specifically looking where we had some advantage, particularly our land and our land holdings, to leverage that into investments in what I would call our backyard. So our backyard investments include Tikotinu Commons. And a lot of times I get a lot of introductions and I say, forget all of that, I am the woman that brought you Target. Yeah, and you need to know no more about me than that. And Fire Island Wind, which is on SERI property. So these are very concrete examples of how we very strategically looked for investments within the state that we could leverage our land and our advantage. And then we also look to how to do business so we are not so dependent on a one economy. And that included looking at all the businesses that we did own and really assessing how risky are those businesses. And it turned out that we had a beta that was greater than the beta for the equity market, which is not a good place to be if you are in for the long haul, you're running an organization that has to go serve not only this generation, but generations to come. We were way too risky. And so the next part of our strategic plan was just make investments outside of Alaska. We happened to choose energy infrastructure. But we've structured those agreements as financial instruments primarily, not necessarily as operating interests. And so that way we hope to strike a balance between investments in our own backyard, because we are here for the long haul. You know, Anchorage in South Central Alaska is SERI's territory, and so we need to do things here, but also broaden our investments beyond the state boundaries so we have geographical diversity, we have diversity beyond businesses that are aligned with the oil and gas industry. So I would in conclusion just say that we are a part of a group that are doing something different. We are not necessarily exporting our profits outside the state of Alaska. We are doing business around the country, around the globe, and importing profits where they get distributed through a dividend stream. And Native corporations that have the capacity to pay dividends, SERI included, have been very generous in paying out dividends to its shareholders. So yes, there is lots of money that's made in Alaska and profits do get exported. But I think Alaska Native corporations now and into the future are going to be really help stabilize some of the economy up here, because we are importers of profits, not exporters of profits. And our shareholders, our headquarters are always going to be here, and our shareholders, for the large part, are always going to live in Alaska. Ceres' percentage of shareholders that live outside of Alaska has pretty much remained unchanged for its 40-plus years of history. So it's we're very stabilizing in the state economy by this virtue of importation of profit.
Thank you. So, Rashmi.
Well, first, on behalf of my three teenage daughters, thank you for bringing Target to... they thank you, I should say. I probably shouldn't, but they thank you. So I think the existential reality of Alaska remains. It's a sparsely populated, vast, remote region, heavily dependent on extractive industries and far away from its markets. So viewed from that perspective, we might be a little insecure, but viewed from that perspective, the economy of Alaska is an amazing and fabulous success. To have built what's been built under those conditions is quite extraordinary. Now, part of my job as dean is to be kind of a, the yenta, the matchmaker, person who goes around and collects gossip from every place and listens. So I get around a lot and I listen to different attitudes. And so if I was a physician and I was taking the pulse of the economy of Alaska right now, I'd say calm down, take a couple of aspirin, get a good night's rest, because it's fragile. Right now the sentiment is very fragile. I think following on a really bruising legislative session like we've had, business sentiment has certainly taken a dive. People are nervous. People are telling stories about the 1980s and rerunning and telling stories about returning their keys to the bank and things like that. But I think an important distinction needs to be made, and that is that this isn't the 1980s, and there are several distinctions. One is that oil is still at a price at which the oil economy as we know it in Alaska is viable, at least the status quo. We're not talking about the oil companies abandoning the state and really trying to liquidate. So we're not at that space. So the government revenues are squeezed, of course, but the oil economy is still viable. And of course, most median scenarios are that it'll continue to be viable and that we'll have continue to have, as Scott Goldsmith would say, the slow squeeze, a kind of a denouement, long denouement of the oil economy, which may not sound wonderful, but again, it's a far cry from the 1980s and from panic and from... There are always these fears in the back of the minds of Alaskans. Once I was in Portland, Oregon, and staying at a hotel, and there was this wonderful coffee table book called Ghost Towns of America, and I started flipping through it, and I thought, oh my goodness, I live in a state where... there are quite a few ghost towns in Alaska, and they're based on mining mostly. But I think that insecurity is always there with Alaskans, and I think that the decade or two to come will be a stressful time for many reasons. One, of course, is that, interestingly enough, we're focused on a handful of variables here, right? The price of oil, the price of money, the federal spending, few policy decisions, and yet the world around us, I mean, everybody should be nervous. Everyone should be nervous, right? We're entering the some people call the second machine age, or I would say really the flowering of the information revolution, to where it's going to saturate every aspect of the economy. Artificial intelligence, driverless cars, automated therapists, which apparently are better than flesh and blood therapists. People like them better because they're willing to disclose more and not be judged. So everyone should be insecure. The world around us is changing very, very rapidly. And so that we're not alone in it. We need to take cognizance of all the shaping landscape as best we can. So the times are nervous, sentiment is fragile. Yet, all is not lost. The oil economy will remain very important for the foreseeable future, and it would appear to be headed for some kind of a denouement rather than a crash, and giving us time to plan and take action for our future.
I suppose one of the good news about kind of a general anxiety is that you can share your general anxieties with your robo-therapist and not feel judged.
Exactly.
So crisis often is perceived as opportunity, and clearly because of the way corporations like RIM and Siri are positioned, you have potential advantages in terms of making an opportunity out of a situation like this. So what do you perceive as kind of the opportunities that exist in Alaska right now?
Take a deep breath, say your prayers, and get to work. So I'm an eternal optimist, and I choose to look for opportunity in times like this. And you know, there are always unanticipated consequences for these sorts of events that turn into fantastic opportunities. And you know, they are beginning to happen. You know, we are going to survive. This is you know, I very well remember a time in 1986-87 when $48 oil would have been heaven. Mm-hmm. Oil was $9 back then. Mm-hmm. And you know, the state was in much worse condition overall than it is now. We have, in my view, a significant perception problem that's pretty pervasive in the public. This is a very, very wealthy state that we live in. And, you know, it is time for us to adjust and study and appreciate the wealth that we enjoy and see that wealth as another resource that we can tap into, or that's not the correct word, but we can make the most of, I guess is a better way of putting it, and continue to flourish as a state and a city and an economy. We have so much potential.
Thank you. Well, if you look around the country, there are states that have had severe downturns, like Oregon in the timber industry, for instance, where they lost their timber industry. Those states went into crisis, went into panic, and many of them came out with stronger economic policies because of the pressure to do something and to figure out how to diversify the economy or get a new economy or rebuild the one that they had just lost or whatever. And one of the frustrations that I have is that, you know, we have been kind of lulled into a great place here in Alaska, and I'm looking at perhaps what we're facing now as an opportunity to really sort of get a handle on how to encourage investment in our economy, how to strengthen those key sectors that are already here, that we won't have to, as you suggest, panic. We should use this kind of opportunity to really focus on how to improve the sectors that we have. I think the statistics will show you that the best way to get growth in an economy is to build on those sectors that are already in the economy. It's a very high risk thing to go out and try to import in something completely new into an economy. So, but we have, I mean, we have, for instance, we have a seafood economy with our fishing. Why can't that be something beyond just food? Why can't that be ocean products like Iceland is doing, where you look at 100% of the product and you say, we're going to use that 100%. Food's one thing, but there are so many other things you can do with ocean products. You could make businesses around collagens and pharmaceuticals and all sorts of things. And so these are basically looking at the resources that you have and trying to figure out how to be more efficient about using the whole value chain, was something that we have not had to do. And I think we have not done a good job in this state of trying to figure out how to really value add to our key sectors. And I see that as perhaps being the opportunity to really, really look hard now at value adding around segments that are already here. In some ways, the last few years, I think all the air has been taken out of the room by debating big oil and what it should be producing for us by way of underpinning our economy. And I think it's taken the air out of the room. There are, as you say, differences between 1980 and now, and that is there are other key sectors like tourism, like our fishing, like that we should, health care, for instance, we should be looking at these segments and saying, how do we add to their sphere? How do we add businesses that help them? How do we add businesses that can then do exports? So I think that is probably for me, what I see as an opportunity to use pressure. I mean, unfortunately, we are humans, and humans kind of don't react very well unless they're, you know, forced to. And so maybe before we fall off a cliff and feel like we're falling off a cliff, maybe we should sort of say, okay, how do we build on what we have and have a robust dialogue beyond just big oil? Because it's here. And it just isn't getting the attention, I think, that it needs to.
So I echo my colleagues here in saying we should appraise, you know, as the Chinese do, crisis is danger plus opportunity. So in that vein, I think we need to take an assessment of the kinds of threats that exist in the economic environment and the business environment. And, of course, the largest one that's apparent is that we're approaching the end of a long commodity cycle. Commodity prices have been high. The Chinese economy, which has been driving much of this, is headed for some very uncertain things. You know, China's very opaque, so we don't know, but China may be headed for a hard landing. In any case, the commodity cycle is playing out, and not just oil prices, but other prices are going to head down, other commodity prices. But there are threats beyond that. There are new technologies, of course, like 3D printing and additive manufacturing, which, for instance, as is being partially realized and eventually will be fully realized, could substitute for 37% of global air cargo, 41% of containerized shipping. So this would, you know, again, we have the fifth busiest air cargo port in the world, and most of the manufactured goods that are flown to North America, they land here. We know the history of aviation and the artifacts that brought that here. And 10% of employment in Anchorage centers around the airport in one form or another. So again, there are major disruptive threats out there. And there are even more if I wanted to upset you and depress you. However, the time has come, in terms of opportunity, the time has come for us to really think of our greatest resources, our human resource, our intellectual resource. In the 21st century, really it can't be anything else. I mean, physical resources, financial resources, we have a plenty, right? We have between 1 and 10% of the world's proven reserves of any mineral you can name, of course, extracted at higher cost and far from end markets. And we have financial capital, of course, that we talk about. But what about the human capital? You know, I look around the room, and I guess I've been here for a while because I think I know a lot of you, and many of you are my former students. And maybe future students. But in any case, in the early 90s, there were many businesses. The Alaska Science and Technology Foundation tried to promote you know, industrial policy of a form. And there are many businesses, you know, whether it's timber and running a lumber yard. And they found that the expertise, the scope of expertise, the depth of expertise was shockingly low. In 25 years, it's changed. You know, I was speaking with a friend yesterday who apparently wrote a satirical piece about the Alaska or the Anchorage business community, and he wasn't terribly impressed with the expertise that we have in business and the intellectual capital. But I think that he was being a curmudgeon, and I'll tell him that next time I see him. Let me scan and see if he's in the room. But you know, the intellectual capital only accumulates slowly, right? It's like filling a bucket with a thimble. You just have to be persistent. Of course, you know I'm heading towards advocating for education, right? That's what I'm going to be doing today. Thank you. But there are opportunities aplenty. Without, you know, I'm running on here as Paul's about to prompt me. But there are, we live and die by the world market. So export promotion and import substitution. So there are many industries that are localizing, and there are many areas where import substitution may be possible. For instance, 3D printing. We could actually do manufacturing in Alaska. At one of the tables is one of my former students who's starting up a hydroponic farming venture, which is very imaginative. They tell me that agriculture is an industry that's ripe for disruption. And she could give you her pitch. It would really excite you. Many of you may not know about these things. So there are extraordinary opportunities, and we have to think again of our human capital as our most valuable resource. But go ahead.
Well, an opportunity that I became aware of during the summer, which somewhat surprised me, although I think it actually makes a lot of sense when you think about it, is in terms of tying in what we do here with the outside, is beer tourism. There are people in the outside who really won't enjoy Alaska craft beers, and they're being brought here in numbers, and that's, you know, it's something that clearly didn't exist even a decade before, but it's something that's there now. But to get to this point, and so this kind of ties into my third question, is how do we, you know, where do we need to invest to actually make these opportunities happen? And in particular, how can we better prepare Alaskans to build that human capital? So I'd like to get your thoughts on that.
We read a lot, we study a lot, we try and figure things out. And we also encourage our employees to always be looking around the edges for a better way to do their job. A little bit of improvement from each employee goes a long way towards making a company more efficient. And you know, that is human capital, mm-hmm. and that is recognizing that there's risk involved in that philosophy, but there is also significant long-term reward involved in that philosophy. You know, we're all always also trying to improve the machine that is our company by, you know, investing. Smart investing in technology, and that is a big, significant component of what has enabled our company to maximize the potential of our diverse locations. You know, Alaska, Guam, Hawaii, California, long way apart. However, we are very well connected through the internet and video systems, so that we work together every day from wherever we are, you know, helping each other. Those are a few examples of some of our approach.
Thank you. Well, sitting as the president and CEO of SERI, I became alarmed by what I perceived as lack of appreciation of private enterprise. And we seem to have lost, I think, a the appreciation of where private enterprise fits in our society and in our economy. And I think that that says we need to have a much better handle on giving our youth an education on economic literacy. I don't think we are producing young people who have that kind of understanding at their core. And I think that one of the things that faces all employers in Alaska is finding that educated workforce. I sit as an independent director currently of Alaska Communications, and I know from the boardroom how difficult it is for them at times to find the trained people here in Alaska to fill the roles that we have in the company. So I think there's just a need for a more robust education of our youth, both in what it takes to be ready for the workforce and also economic literacy. How does private enterprise fit in to the economy? And like I said, just, you know, I know at SERI, when we were trying to build a Fire Island Wind project, we heard from people in the Alaska legislature that SERI could not be trusted to do this because it was a private enterprise, which is a shocking thing to hear when you look at the lower 48, where public-private partnerships are flourishing in this business, where private enterprise is willing to step up and take enormous risk, construction risk and business risk, for what is a steady but nominal return. And yet to be accused of not being trustworthy just because we happen to be a for-private corporation, I think, it says a lot about the need to really have a citizenry that once again embraces private enterprise as an important place in our economy. And I think that that is also will help when we do that, that will help with innovation, because I think we really truly need to be innovative. We have to teach our young people to be innovative. As private corporations, we need to celebrate innovation. I don't know how many times at SERI I would hear, we don't do it that way because we've always done it this other way. And it's, you know, maybe that's human nature too, but it's like, no, you don't have to do it the same way just because that's how you've always done it. So we do need to sort of instill this view that innovation is really where you're going to get growth in productivity, and that we, the government, the state university system, the state of Alaska needs to be encouraging this, and private enterprise needs to be celebrating it where we find it. And I think those are the things that really are going to be needed most as we sort of look out at this brave new world that we're facing.
So it's really telling that in an economy that's slowing, businesses still report that they can't hire the people they want to, the qualified people they want to, the IT professionals, the financial analysis professionals, and others. A few minutes ago, Ms. Brown told a good news story about SERI as evolving as a multi-location, even multinational company, which imports profits back to the state. But the downside that I can envision, not the downside of SERI becoming more diversified, but if we would envision that therefore Anchorage becomes a business headquarters city, and that this multinational enterprise is managed from here, of course, we'll run into the constraints of the supply of business professionals, the supply of financial talent, and marketing talent, managerial talent, and all that. So without producing those kinds of human resources, opportunities like those will not be realized. And her company and others will, against their wishes, they will gravitate to other business centers like Seattle and Dallas and Sydney, Australia, and other places around the world. So that is a cautionary tale. So therefore, certainly investment in education is critical. But I think that we can leverage. Of course, I'm always here to say three cheers for the university, if I can rally that. But I think that we can leverage the combination of cabin fever and island fever that our young people grow up with, right? One of my students who runs a franchise most of you know around town, a series of these companies, of these shops, I asked him how many countries he's visited. He told me he liked to travel, and he's in his 30s, and it's 60. And he's just gotten started because he knows there's 200 countries in the world, and he hasn't explored the capacity. So the university can be a source of importing social and cultural capital for the state. We have a grand total of 6 students from the People's Republic of China at UAA. We have 12 from Mongolia. And I think the Mongolian students, they came here intentionally. I think the Chinese ones may be lost. But in any case, the university is an attractor of international students, just to get to up to the levels that we really should be, is something that is underrealized. The ties, the capital, the relationships that our professors have. I'll tell you a brief story about a study abroad program that we piloted. 10 students went to China on a tour of business opportunities in China, including the headquarters of KPMG in China, and our seafood marketing, and so on and so forth. These students had to put up quite a lot of money in a short amount of time in order to do this. And so the market speaks. Those students, some of our best, most astute students, understood the value of investing in their education, putting up, you know, $4,000 or $5,000 each as students to go on this tour. They understood the value of making those ties, of seeing the world, of enhancing, you know, their horizons, their cultural intelligence. So Anchorage really should be not just a great business city, but it should be a gateway to the rest of Alaska and a gateway for Alaska to the world. It should be a highly cosmopolitan business city where our young people who love to travel, in fact, the person I referred to who had traveled to 60 countries, he had went to Spain on the spur of the moment, and while he's at it, he's making business connections for the future. So I think that investing in higher education, but also understanding the many, many facets of what a first-class university can do for a community, including building its cultural capital, its social capital, is important. Anyway, and I'm sure I've talked for too long.
And I would also echo just the idea of helping the folks, make folks in Anchorage realize that we are actually a university town. We don't quite have the consciousness of it. I think we ought to. But
could I interject? So, is Anchorage a university town? I've had this conversation over and over again. A former chancellor said Anchorage is a university town, but just doesn't know it. I actually think, you know, I've asked a few people this question. Anchorage is a blank town. What kind of town? Only polite answers allowed. Some people answer this by saying Anchorage is a business town. Others say it's a government town. Is Anchorage a university town? I think that we're not unlike other cities where business is a driver and government is a driver, in that the university and the business side have to have a deep partnership, and the university has to grow to be worthy of the city and also help the city realize its potential fully. Anyway, my editorial, sorry to...
So, well, that's, I think, a very important perspective. So, history tells us that this crisis, like others before it, will pass, and we will find a happy place, theoretically, again. So, thinking of the future, projecting forward 10, 15 years, what do you see the basic state of the Alaska economy, and what would you like your position in it to be?
I see the economy, I'm thinking back to 10 years ago compared to today, and I had a vision then, and what we have now is significantly different than that vision would have indicated. And, you know, in many ways, it's better than that vision would have indicated. So, you know, I really look forward to the next 10 years. I think we have so much, as I've said earlier, I've emphasized, we are in a period of adjustment, which means there is so much potential that we can realize as we adjust and go forward. You know, the economy is going to morph into Alaska's position in the global economy, taking advantage of our location, as has occurred with the airport and the freight traffic that we enjoy. I think there will be more and more of those sort of opportunities that we see. I believe that RIM, our company, will also be a part of that as we evolve and develop the relationships that we have around the world who, you know, they want to come to Alaska and they're inviting us to go to their countries. So those opportunities are going to, I believe, more and more come about during the next 10 to 15 years as the economy evolves. China is a huge country. I was able to spend 10 days there a year ago on business, and I was just so amazed at the openness of the people that we interacted with and how welcoming they were compared to the impression that you get by government-to-government interaction. It's totally different when you're dealing with you know, like individuals to myself, and you know that visit is going to result in relationship opportunities that will mean work opportunities, both ways for our company as well as the companies that we're interacting with there. So I'm encouraged and cautious.
Yes, thank you. Well, I think 15 years out, Alaska's distance from the rest of the world is going to have been diminished because there will be information technology, there'll be hopefully all the young people that are coming out of the university, networking globally, traveling, doing what they want to do around the world. So I see the distance between us and the rest of the world diminishing over the next 15 years. I also agree that there is pressure on prices, raw commodity prices. I mean, we see that with oil, but you know, we will continue to see that, I think, going forward. So I do think that, you know, beginning to sound like a broken record, I think our challenge will be during that next 15 years is to figure out a way to value add on some of these raw products so we are not just a producer and an exporter of raw goods anymore. I think Alaska's native corporations will continue to have a growing presence in the economy. They will, as I indicated, be making investments here, but also outside of the state and importing those profits in. I think there will be businesses that will be continued to be sold. I know we just had this announcement of the seafood, is it Icicle Seafoods in Southeast that's being sold. So we've had that before. We've got, you know, Alaska Airlines, our Cars grocery store is now a Safeway, even our National Bank of Alaska as Wells Fargo. Those kind of things will continue, but I do see that Alaska Native corporations can become an even more stabilizing influence on our economy by nature of the fact that their headquarters are going to be remaining here in Alaska and serving their broad shareholder base and actually employing a lot of people who are not their shareholders in the businesses that they run here and in their headquarters that they have here. So I think I'm optimistic that, you know, we will figure this out, and I think that as far as Alaska Native corporations go, they will be ever more important to Alaska as we go forward.
So I think the next 15 years for Alaska will certainly be a time of reckoning. And I think it's many of us know that this was coming, and it was probably deferred and delayed because of the exceptionally high price of oil for many years. So a challenging time, really sort of a time in which all of our institutions will be audited, metaphorically speaking, maybe literally also. But it's important to remember that when it comes down to it, the health of a society really is based on the quality of its institutions, the resilience of its institutions, and I mean everything from government institutions to educational institutions, business institutions, markets, law, the rest of it. And I think the good news is that we're still a young state, and we have a lot of potential for maturing and improving. I look at, say, roughly 200 village corporations and their potential for growth. I look at the evolution of the corporate form for the regional corporations. And they're evolving kind of a model of capitalism with Alaska Native cultural characteristics that's very promising, so that they have, you know, more attention to the triple bottom line. So I think that this is a time that of transition. It's a time in which we'll be tested, but it's a time in which it's a time really that good leadership can help to develop our institutions for a healthier society, you know, so that we, you know, every society goes through ups and downs. In the Bible, it used to say 7 lean years and 7 fat years. I mean, this was known. So we must think of it in this way and remember that the health of our institutions and the quality of leadership and the quality of our people is what really matters and what will help us endure. But this will be the reckoning.
Yeah, just a quick follow on to those comments. You know, over the next 10 to 15 years, I see this as a time that we will go through that will result in an improvement. The oil industry, for example, will adjust to the price, and that business will become creative to figure out how to deal with $48 oil as compared to $110 oil, and improve their systems and procedures, and continue to improve and be profitable. And I think that will happen throughout the economy. It has already happened in our business. You know, we went through a number of years with continuous, significant profitability. The economy flipped over in 2008. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we had to really adjust and improve. The tide will come back in. We are a much better company now after having gone through those adjustments and improvements. Yes, painful. However, much better. So come on back in here, Tide.
So, well, certainly one of the reasons why we felt the need to put on this particular program, of course, once again, I will remind folks that this program is being brought to us courtesy of the Humanities Forum, so we thank them. But part of the debate, or much of the debate, regarding our current situation indicated to us that perhaps the number one deficit that Alaska is facing right now is not so much money, but of imagination. And the question arises is, how do we get more Alaskans to realize that the economic paradigm of Alaska has changed, and due to both domestic and global situations, has really changed irrevocably. There's just no going back to that. So we wanted to put this together as a way of starting that conversation. But the question is now, I mean, how do we get that conversation, how do we keep that conversation going? How do we convince our fellow Alaskans about, first of all, the truth of the fact that their economic paradigm has changed, the vital role that this new or this more diverse Alaskan economy can play in securing our future, and the kinds of public and private investments that this economy is going to require. So how do we carry on this conversation? I'll ask for your thoughts, kind of randomly.
Well, if I could go first, I think that it has already been said that this is going to require really leadership from the top. And that's, you know, through our government leaders, through leaders of businesses that are in these key sectors. I just think that we have not had the benefit of really strong leadership around industrial policies and economic development that we have needed for some time. I chaired a group called Alaska Forward for my last few years at SERI, and it was so hard to get anybody to really pay attention to the work we were doing to try to bolster the economic strength of our state by looking at what's called cluster work, businesses that are in related businesses collaborating together. And it was clear to me that we will have to have leadership from the top to, as you say, convince the citizenry that now is the time. I mean, I would hope that at some point we would have an economic commission or an industrial policy or something, call it whatever you want, which is driven by leaders of both from the government and these key sectors, to at a minimum, I would say, figure out how it is easier to invest and produce in this state. Because, you know, that is, we really need to work on that too. I mean, we have not mentioned that yet, but we really need to work on how to make it easier to do these things that we feel are necessary for our economy. How do we get through the permitting process in a timely fashion? How do we deal with the extra costs? How do we deal with the lack of labor? Whatever it might be, we have to have a commission, a group of people who are looking at how to make things easier to do. Because it is extraordinarily hard to do anything in this state. I tell you about Tikotinu Commons, that we have had a very, very good real estate partner who develops these kind of facilities all over the country. He had never found a place more difficult and more challenging to get from the concept to the end as he did out there on Glen Highway, Tikotinu Commons. So that tells me that we have a lot of work to do to figure out how to make it easier to do business in this state. And a lot of that has to do with very strong leadership, political leadership and business leadership, and because it is ultimately going to have to be the citizens of this state who embrace the idea that, you know, we need these kind of investments to have a robust economy here, so we have jobs for our children, and we have the things that you expect from where you live, the services that you need, jobs for yourself and your children, and a community around you that's healthy in every way. So I think it's going to be a real challenge because we have not been so successful, I don't think, in the recent past. But I do believe that we have institutions now that are trying to chip away at this. We've got, you know, the Institute of the North. We've got Commonwealth North. We had Alaska Forward, ICER, University. We have people working on micro investments. So it's not as if we're lacking institutions. We are lacking the ability to sort of pull it all together and be guided by from the top that this is of utmost importance for us. Thank you.
So I think that Ms. Brown is I agree with her very much that working across institutional boundaries is important. I think organizational theory tells you that in a highly uncertain environment, you have to work against the existing silos of your organization. You have to coordinate across silos and work as teams. Imagine how much more difficult it is to work across the boundaries of organizations. But it's been done. I'll give you a few examples. Sometimes, even in lieu of enlightened government, in Pittsburgh, in the declining days of steel, and they were facing much more severe crisis than we are, you had collaborative work between the medical complexes and the universities to essentially create a place-based economic development by leveraging their joint purchasing power, for instance, to attract businesses to locate, to create those clusters. In a place like Detroit today, they've tried to replicate that in Midtown Detroit, which I visited just a few weeks ago, and it's unrecognizable. Normally, when I'd walk on the streets of Detroit, you know, I would not waste time. I'd go straight, park in the secure place. Midtown is not like that. Wayne State University, Detroit Medical Center, and a whole host of sister institutions have created this economic zone in Midtown Detroit. And the government is dysfunctional, and it's in receivership. And they still did it. And of course, one of the secrets I was told was that they got the wherewithal to actually expand their own security forces. And now, you know, the market speaks. Real estate prices have gone up, and they're comparable to the suburbs, so that you can see that even interinstitutional cooperation in localities can make a difference. Up and down the city or in every town in Alaska. But again, I think that leadership and cooperation across institutional boundaries is key. And that is not easy. That is not easy. That is why we have to not only improve our institutions as they exist, but we need the kind of leadership that creates that looks for and creates ties and cooperative relationships across.
So someone once said that necessity is the mother of invention. And you know, we are in a period of necessity, and we are going to become very, very inventive and creative. And that is good. We will improve. Regarding leadership and the attitude of leadership, I believe that a paradigm shift in leadership attitude will help us. And the shift I'm talking about in attitude is an attitude of what can we do as leaders to help things to happen, and move away from the attitude of, as leaders, we better be looking out for everything that's gonna, all the trouble we're gonna run into if we do it and look for reasons not to move forward. So significant paradigm shift, and I believe it can happen. I believe it can really significantly make a difference in Anchorage. With a paradigm shift that I believe we are going to see with the new administration, and that sort of shift could be very good for us as a state as well.
So to conclude, I want to refer to our kind of Anchorage centennial theme, that is why we're here after all, and ask you briefly, just looking back over the last 100 years, is there something we could have done differently? Is there a choice that was or was not made that would have altered our present condition? And while we certainly cannot change the past, is it too late to make that choice? Can we still choose a different path now? So I'd like to ask your thoughts on that.
Well, I mean, we could. Let me put my cards on the table here, my union cards on the table, and say that we could have endowed education. We could have endowed education. We could have made the material basis underlying education more sound so that we wouldn't have to come to the edge of the cliff as we did a couple of months ago, where apparently we were contemplating the severe damage to our basic educational institutions and other institutions. So I think that when the revenues were there, I think had we spent money like that, I think there's probably an occasion for regret. Mm-hmm. And is it too late? Probably not, but it would have been easier years ago.
Larry?
Well, nobody has mentioned the permanent fund and creating a permanent fund that is the holy grail that nobody can touch, but maybe I won't either. It's all right.
Oh, come on, Mark.
Yeah. You can read between the lines on that. I think that the statehood, we recognized that our resources were being exploited, and I particularly believe it was around fishing that the fishing resources were being exploited, and we needed to have our say. We needed to be a state to deal with the exploitation of our resources. And so I think that we probably could have been a little bit more focused throughout the years of moving away from just the raw export to try to actually do something beyond that. We have come so far down that road, and I recognize it's the easier road, and that doing value added is very, very difficult, but I think we could have been working at this better and more efficiently all along, certainly since I don't know about 100 years, but certainly since statehood. And I would also then go back to the point about our institutions. We really have to make sure our institutions, who are we're going to rely on to sort of work together or break through these silos, I think we may have allowed some of them to be entrenched too long. So it's so difficult now to actually make changes, either in the legal structure, in the boardroom climate, you know, whatever it might be. Making changes are very, very difficult. People get rattled by change. But I think that this idea of being able to modernize our institutions and embrace innovations is going to be slow in coming to some of these institutions because we have not forced them to do that early enough and fast enough to really help us right now. So I would say a little bit of entrenchment that we were very happy with, didn't feel the need to sort of force change, I think is one of the reasons that we are struggling now to sort of catch up where we are with our current economic situation. I won't call it a crisis, but our current economic challenge and opportunity.
All right, that'll be the last word.
So I believe that we had some excellent leadership back when we started as a state to generate a tremendous amount of revenue from the flow of oil and from the our extraction of that resource, and a savings account was created that is now known as the permanent fund, and management of that fund has been very successful. $54 billion. How much is 1% of $54 billion? $540 million. That's a lot of money. That was a good decision that we made, that our leaders made back in the day to create that fund. I'm not sure the decision to create the dividend was as good. I'm concerned that that decision has resulted in an entitlement mentality that is pervasive across the state, and I don't think it can ever be changed. Maybe it can be tweaked. Maybe the dividend can be capped. I know I'm getting on kind of sacred ground here, but you know, we do need to be brave, especially now with the opportunity we have, and take a look at some ways to improve that.
Well, with that, I think we've more or less drawn to the conclusion of our program. I want to very much thank our panelists very much.